This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Grab your pants.
Good morning, listeners. You are tuned in to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. This is Priya and I'm in the studio with Zakia. Good morning.
Good morning, Priya.
How's it going?
Good. How was your morning? Now, how you start your morning?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was pretty good. It's nice that it's so light outside.
And also a bit warmer.
Yes, and a little bit warmer. Although I know we're going to switch back to daylight. No, wait. To daylight savings time. No, the opposite way. Whatever way it is, our clocks are going to switch on the weekend. So we're going to go back to slightly darker mornings. I think we lose an hour.
So we have to change the timing and stuff in the...
It automatically updates, I think, on everything. It automatically updates on my phone. But yes, oh no, your wristwatch? Yes, you will have to change it. So everybody just bear in mind things switch over this weekend.
Yeah.
I can also, you might be able to hear it in my voice, but I can also really feel that the pollen count is going up. My eyes and nose have been so itchy. I've been sneezing all over the place, stocking up on antihistamines. Yeah. So we have a great lineup for you on today's show. Do you want to tell us what we have to get started?
We will start. We'll play a talk by Ana Cha of Brazil's Landless Workers Movement, MST, on the story of MST's organizing around food overweight, and issues that movement has championed for over 40 years. This talk originally aired on 3CR's Earth Matters program on 18th of May, 2025.
Yeah, cool. Yeah. You know, you're right. It was from the Food Sovereignty Day event from the 12th of April this year. And then after that, I am devastated to say that we have reached the end of the Our Stories, Our Flats series. So this is the final episode. Hopefully not the last forever. I know there are many people around that want a season two, but this will be the last episode for now of Our Stories, Our Flats, produced by Ayan Shirwa. And in this episode, we're going to hear from Arku from 44 Flats United about the campaign to defend public housing, and from community advocate Barry Berra to share what motivated him to take Homes Victoria to court. And after that, Inez caught up with File Explorer about their latest club night fantasy break, which started in early 2025 to champion the sounds of footwork from Chicago and jungle from London. And he took this opportunity to further showcase alternative dance music in NARM with queer, trans and femme selectors. So they're going to speak about how their first club night went. And we're also going to be promoing their club night tomorrow, Friday, the 3rd of October at QQQ. QQQ Street Park. Okay, I'm going to look that up again because I don't know if I'm saying that right, but it's number 2 Peel Street, Collingwood, from 7 p.m. to 1 a.m. Yeah. And we do have an exclusive discount for Thursday Breakfast listeners. So stay tuned for that and we will let you know how to claim it. And finally, we're joined by Vicky McNamara, a senior research associate at UNSW's Center for the Future of the Legal Profession. And Vicky's joining us to discuss concerns about the use of generative AI in the Australian legal system, including by an increasing number of self-representing litigants. So this is something that I hadn't even thought about previously, but of course it makes sense if people are facing financial barriers to access justice, that they might be looking for sources of what they're hoping is credible information when they're representing themselves in court. But as Vicky's going to discuss with us, this can lead to some really serious concerns about, you know, compromising the process of cases that may be valid. So definitely stay tuned for that. You're listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and we'll be back with you shortly with our news headlines.
And I don't believe in fighting today in any one front, but on all fronts. In fact, I'm a black nationalist freedom fighter.
This country is a nation of thieves.
Now, we're never going to get justice here in these filthy racist courts here.
Our people have been massacred, and we're not supposed to grieve for that. We've got to do something more drastic if we're serious about this.
Move over or we going to move on over you.
Yilliman with Kieran Stewart-Asherton on 3CR. Dives deep into Indigenous resistance and global anti-colonial struggles. Featuring frontline activists, it confronts Australia's identity, challenges power structures, and fuels revolutionary discourse. Wednesdays, 12 to 1 p.m.
These are the news headlines for Thursday, the 2nd of October. So leaked shipping records reveal that at least 68 shipments of F-35 fighter jet parts have been secretly flown from so-called Australia to Israel since October 2023, including one as recently as September on a Thai Airways passenger flight, a new declassified Australia report reveals. Many of the shipments were marked for Israel's Nevatim Air Base, home to its F-35 squadrons, with shipments spiking after Israel's bombing of Gaza began. The revelations raise questions about the federal government's role in arming Israel, despite Labor's repeated denials, and about the safety of using civilian aircraft to transport military cargo into an active war zone. Meanwhile, so-called peace plan backed by the United Nations has emerged that would give international powers control over Gaza with little to no Palestinian input. Palestinian critics say the scheme repackages colonialism under the guise of neutrality and development, further sidelining Palestinian rights and resistance. This comes as Israel continues its genocidal bombardment of Gaza City, killing several Palestinians daily, destroying residential buildings and schools, and forcing tens of thousands of Palestinians to flee the south when attacks from Israeli forces continue. In related news, the global Samud flotilla, consisting of 50 vessels from 44 countries, has entered high-risk waters as Israel prepares to intercept it with warships. Israeli media has been reporting plans to seize activists, deport them, and even sink some ships at sea, raising urgent concerns over international law and the safety of the flotilla activists. And at the time that we're speaking right now, it appears that several of the ships have been intercepted by the Israeli military, and that water cannons have been deployed against the vessels Ulara and Meteke. So violence appears to be escalating against the flotilla. Real concerns about some of the vessels being intercepted and boarded, and an urgent call from the Sumud flotilla for governments around the world to step up and intervene on behalf of people that are attempting to break the genocidal siege on Gaza. In Narm, Bayside City Council has unanimously adopted a discredited definition of anti-Semitism from the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance. Protesters who gathered outside a council meeting said the definition is being used to silence dissent in the community about the genocide in Gaza and to shield Israel from scrutiny. Jewish protesters reported vile abuse from other community members, warning the council definition threatens free speech and civil liberties. As of this week, also in headlines, Victoria has officially raised the age of criminal responsibility to 12 years old. But human rights groups say the reform falls short, warning it should be lifted to at least 14 in line with expert advice and international standards. This comes as First Nations and legal advocates argue that the government is undermining the raising of criminal responsibility age by simultaneously tightening bail laws, which they say will increase incarceration rates for vulnerable children, particularly First Nations young people. Critics accuse Premier Jacinta Allen's government of prioritising police and media pressure over evidence-based, community-led solutions to youth justice. In other news, a federal court class action has been launched against the government, alleging the Remote Community Development Program, a Work for the Dole scheme in place from 2015 to 2021, racially discriminated against First Nations people and caused widespread harm. The lawsuit claims around 20,000 Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander participants were forced to work longer hours under harsher conditions than urban counterparts, leading to financial hardship, trauma, and distress. Also in headlines, Venezuelan President Maduro says he is prepared to declare a state of emergency if the United States escalates military aggression following strikes on boats that killed at least 17 people earlier this month. As the United States deploys warships and fighter jets to the Caribbean, President Maduro signed a decree granting himself special powers to mobilize the army and defend against what his government describes as an undeclared war. Activists rallied in Gadigal country in Sydney to express solidarity with Venezuelan sovereignty and urged federal Labor government to oppose United States intervention. And finally in headlines, Dr. Amy McQuire's book Black Witness has won the Queensland Premier's Award for a work of state significance at the state's yearly literary awards. The book critiques the violence of politics and mainstream media in Queensland, with Dr. McQuire remarking in her speech that the book is, quote, about acknowledging the fact that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people can and should be believed, particularly when telling their own experiences. Despite its pretenses of speaking truth to power, the media actually does the opposite when it comes to blackfellas, end quote. Dr. McQuire encouraged young First Nations journalists to aspire to working beyond the imperial media. These have been the news headlines for Thursday, the 2nd of October, and you're listening to 3CR on 855 AM.
Standing Together for Public Housing is a campaign to stop the privatisation of public housing. Come to a public meeting at 6 PM on the 23rd of October at the Capitol Theatre to have your say on how to maintain and build more public housing instead of knocking it down. 6 PM Thursday, 23rd of October at the Capitol Theatre, 113 Swanson Street, Melbourne. For more details, see the Standing Together for Public Housing Facebook page. The Public Housing Campaign is a 3CR supporter.
You're listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and it is 7:13 in the morning. And I'm going to be saying this a couple of times during the show, but thanks to Tony Birch, last week we were able to start a giveaway for Michaela Sahar's beautiful book, Find Me at the Jaffa Gate, and we now have a winner. So congratulations to Liz Shield. We really appreciate everyone entering the draw, and thank you again to Tony for giving us a copy of the book, which weaves together glimpses into Palestinian diasporic life. So Liz, we will be in touch with you later to organize pickup, and thanks so much for your support of 3CR. Now, over to you.
We will play a talk by Ana Cha of Brazil's Landless Workers Movement, MST, on the story of MST's organizing around food sovereignty, an issue that movement has championed for over 40 years. This talk originally aired on 3CR's Earth Matters program on 18th of May 2025. And was presented at the event's Food Sovereignty Day on the 12th of April 2025, which has coordinated by Lancet Degrowth, Network Australia, and Gorilla Grading Naram Collective.
Calling into a recent food sovereignty convergence in Naram, Melbourne, here's Ana Cha, member of the National Coordinators Network of the Landless Workers Movement, about how it came to be and its vision for the food system in Brazil and beyond.
So in Brazil, the question of access to land and the ownership of land has always been a very important issue. And we used to say that the question of land, it's in the root, even today, of the great social inequality that exists in our country. For you to have a dimension of what that means, still today, 1% of the landowners own more than 50% of all the land in Brazil. So it's very concentrated, the land. And on the other hand, we still have more than 5 million landless people who could potentially live and work in the land. So the struggle for land has always been in part of our historical struggles. Whether it's in colonial times, the struggle of the indigenous people, but also the struggle of peoples who were enslaved and who even sought the right to create free communities, which were called quilombos, that still until today are a great inspiration for all of us who believe the land should fulfill a social function and not to be in the hands of just a few people. But even after the legal signature of the end of slavery, the land was never been democratized and remained in the hands of those few landowners, which usually were politicians or very rich people. So it's in this process of struggles for land that MST emerged 41 years ago. It was in 1984, the foundation of our movement. And Brazil lived a moment of re-democratization. We have had 21 years military dictatorship, and it was a very difficult moment for all those who live and try to build a different perspective of what were in that moment in government. And so there was a lot of persecution against all leftist political organizations and especially also social movements, peasant movements. But MST emerged as a social movement that struggled for land. But also since the beginning, it was a movement who was claiming for a project of agrarian reform and had a perspective of social transformation and human emancipation. So land was the first goal, the first even necessity of people who join MST. Landless people usually are very poor people because they don't have the means of productions to are able to survive from their work. So they join MST in this goal to have a small piece of land to produce. But since the beginning, the movement had in this perspective a biggest goal of social transformation. So when MST joined together with other social movements, especially peasant movements, also some indigenous movements from all over the world, and they found the La Via Campesina, which is this international network that defends the right of peasants, defends a perspective of agriculture on agroecology principles, and of course one of the pillars of the struggle of the program of La Via Campesina, it's food sovereignty, which is very basically the right to decide what to produce, how to produce, and for whom to produce. And doing that, we are also saying that we need to decide what we want to eat. No, so food cannot be a commodity. Food, it's a human right. And of course, not just for the peasants, but for all people. In Brazil, the agriculture system is dominated by agribusiness companies and also some latifundios. This huge amount of land who are owned by just a few landowners. And what is the result of this concentration of land and this so unequal distribution of land? Well, the result is the growing of hunger. The food we eat, it's full of poison. We are seeing that our soil, the countryside environment is being destroyed. And even the people in the city, they became hostage of ultra processed and expensive and unhealthy food, even if sometimes that food is labeled as healthy food or food from the future or whatever. So it's a combination of the model of producing from agribusiness sector, but also this huge cultural industry and propaganda machine that makes people believe that this kind of way of producing and doing agriculture, it's the right way and it's the most modern and it's what we need to support. So it's a very concrete struggle for land and for having the means of production and the means of doing agriculture, but it's also a struggle in the subjective ways. It's a struggle for who defines the imaginary of what is fair, what is healthy, what is good for everybody, and in our case, what is the model of agriculture that we should have society support. So our struggle and what we are proposing is that the model of agribusiness, this agriculture that is based on monoculture, that is based on producing with pesticides, with poison, this way of producing to export and not to feed an internal market and feed the people, we believe that it's not a good option for our society, not even in Brazil, not in any other country of the world. And in opposed to that, we are proposing what we are calling people's agrarian reform. When MST was found in our program, we wish to say that we are fighting for agrarian reform in a classic way of thinking agrarian reform. Basically, redistribute land for those who don't have land and want to work on land and plant on land. But with the advance of all the capitalist system, with the advance of agribusiness, we somehow redefined that term of agrarian reform, and we say now what makes sense for us is to talk about people's agrarian reform. And what is just the difference? The difference is it's not just the land that need to be redistributed. We need to build a new country project. And that has land has one of the main cores, but land to be produced with based on agroecology, in the respect of nature, in the respect of peasant culture, peasant food culture, and people's control of territories. And of course, that means we need to have autonomy to produce. We need to make our production based on collective work, on equal participation of men and women, with peasant education, with the sharing of ancestral knowledge, but also with technology. We used to say it's make the countryside again a good place to live, a place not just to produce commodities, but a place where it's good to live. So this is one of our greatest slogans, that people's agrarian reform, it's a way of living better. And not just in the countryside, because if we are saying we are going to produce good food, healthy food, food produced based on non-oppressed relations, we truly believe that the way that food will be received and for the people in the city, it will improve the life of everybody.
Anna Cha of the Landless Workers Movement on agricultural reform as a thoroughly political project.
We're talking about ecological thinning and subsidised logging, but we basically mean the same things, don't we, here?
Wherever there are chemical corporations around the world, they're constantly trying to chip away at regulations.
Earth Matters, bringing you environmental and social justice stories from developments in government and industry to the campaigns and communities that are standing up to them. Earth Matters plays at 11 a.m. Sunday and 6:30 a.m. Wednesday. Turn your dial to 855 a.m. or listen online at 3cr.org.au.
While the headlines have subsided, the nuclear power plant is still not under control, with the spent fuel rods removed from only one out of four reactors.
Law needs to change so that our rights can be recognised, so that decisions in relation to the use and exploitation of our lands is out.
Help 3CR raise funds by donating your containers. Every eligible drink container that you return to a container deposit scheme recycling point earns 10 cents, which can really add up. 3CR is a donation partner for Victoria's Container Deposit Scheme. The scheme allows you to recycle selected aluminium, glass, or plastic containers and donate the funds earned to a not-for-profit organisation of your choice. Help us raise funds for the station. Search for Community Radio and choose 3CR next time you cash in your cans. Go to cdsvic.org.au for more information.
The Environmental Film Festival is back, running from the 16th to the 23rd of October across Melbourne, Footscray, Fitzroy and Elwood. Enjoy Australia's premier environmental cinema showcase with 23 films, 14 premieres, 4 talks and 2 community gatherings, all exploring ideas of urban living, nature and beyond. Plus celebrate the team's 15th year with a very special anniversary party. In this time of climate crises, reconsider the world around you and experience how environment is everywhere with the Environmental Film Festival 2025. Tickets on sale now at environmentalfilms.org.au.
Presented by Environmental Films Australia, a 3CR supporter.
VCR is about community, and we welcome your participation at the station.
3CR is open to a wide diversity of volunteers and is a great way to connect with Melbourne's activist community.
Have you ever thought about volunteering, doing a reception shift, getting a program on air,
training in radio skills, or contributing to one of the station's committees?
There are many ways to be involved at 3CR.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au and get in touch.
You're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and you just heard a talk by Anna Cha of Brazil's Landless Workers Movement, or MST, on the story of MST's organizing around food sovereignty, an issue that the movement has championed for over 40 years. And this talk originally aired on 3CR's Earth Matters program on the 18th of May 2025 and was presented at the event Food Sovereignty Day on the 12th of April 2025, which was coordinated by LASNET, Degrowth Network Australia, and Guerrilla Gardening NARM Collective. Thanks again to Mia from Earth Matters for sharing this audio with us. And remember, you can catch Earth Matters every Sunday from 11 to 11:30 a.m. on 3CR 855 a.m. And now we have another news update from Zakia.
The update, we have the Taliban bans internet across Afghanistan. The Taliban has cut off internet access across the country. It's now been almost 2 days that people in Afghanistan have had no internet. Millions of people can no longer use social media, contact family abroad, or access online education. Critics says the ban is aimed at controlling information and silencing voices While many warn it will make life even harder and leave Afghan more isolated from the world.
Yeah. Yeah, highly concerning.
It is concerning. I think it's acting off in an inhuman way.
Yeah, and just really completely, I guess, like devoid of the, you know, attention to what this will do to people in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
Right. And actually, I'll add another update on that because we're going to be speaking with you across today's show at a time where Israel is firing water cannons at activists in small boats that are trying to break its illegal blockade of Gaza. So as we mentioned in the headlines, the global Samud flotilla has been intercepted by the Israeli military. At least two boats have defied Israeli commanders, telling them to stop, and they've carried on sailing. They're approximately within 60 nautical miles of Gaza. And boats, including the Ulara and the Metek, have been water cannoned by the Israeli military. So really concerning. Please head to globalsamudflotilla.org to find out more about what you can do to take immediate action to put pressure on governments around the world. Thank you, Zakia, for that update. And now we are going to go to the final segment of hopefully season one of Our Stories, Our Flats.
Yeah, I love that. That was interesting.
Yeah. And Our Stories, Our Flats has been an amazing series produced by Ayan Sherwa. And in this episode, we're going to hear from Arku from 44 Flats United about the campaign to defend public housing and from community advocate Barry Betta, who shares what motivated him to take Homes Victoria to court. So thank you again, Ayan, for an incredible series, and I hope everyone's enjoyed it.
Our Stories, Our Flats acknowledges the traditional owners of the Kulin Nations. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present. Welcome to Our Stories, Our Flats, a four-part podcast series about living and thriving in the Carlton Public Estates. Our Stories, Our Flats was created by and for the residents of the Carlton Flats. Written, produced and edited by Ayan Shoiwa. Narration by Raven. It is a 3CR podcast. Special thanks to the City of Melbourne for helping us share it with the world. Today's episode is the final show in the series. It's where we explore solutions from public housing advocates. If you've been following us, you know that our community is brave, resilient and resourceful. Carlton residents hold differing views on whether the buildings should be demolished or renovated. One thing is clear though, the community must be involved in the decision-making process, not as an afterthought, but every step of the way. We begin the final episode with Arku, the founder of 44 Flats United, a group made up of residents, former residents, and supporters of public housing. Arku grew up in the Carlton Flats, and at a tender young age, she was made to feel ashamed of living in the high-rise flats. In 2025, she's proud of her roots and now fights to protect public housing.
Hi everyone, my name is Arku. I grew up in the Carlton Flats and the Carlton Estate throughout the 90s and 2000s. Currently, I am involved in 44 Flats United. So I'm the founder and the leader of 44 Flats United, or 44FU. Our group was established so that we could have a space for residents and former residents to organise against the demolition plans for the 44 high-rises across Melbourne. Growing up in Carlton fundamentally has shaped who I am today, and I think it'll continue to shape me for the rest of my life. Born and raised in the Carlton Estate, as I mentioned earlier, from the very beginning, my mum really wanted my sister and I, despite living on the estate, to have access to everything that was available in community. She made the decision to send us to the primary school that wasn't on the estate, so that's Carlton North Primary School. That experience shaped me. Before I went to Carlton North Primary School, I was really proud of living in the flats. I thought it was the coolest thing that we lived high up, that we had these really cool views, that our building was visible from all over the city. And then when I went to school, I think that's the only time I realized that the flats is where the poor people live, that it's something that you should be ashamed of. I have a memory of going on a school excursion. I would have been to like the swimming pool, and our bus went past the flats. And I just remember this person, this girl in the back, let's go with the name Hannah. When I was like, oh, hey, everyone, look, it's my home. Hannah was like, oh, my God, Aku, I didn't know you lived in the flats. And I was just overwhelmed with shame and embarrassment. And every single bus trip from that day on for the rest of my time, I ducked my head down every time we went past the flats out of fear that someone would be like, hey, everyone, that's where Aku lives. Like, it's so bizarre, but that memory has really, like, I really internalized that. Forty-Four Flats United is a group of residents, former residents, and supporters of public housing. We established ourselves to ensure that not one person would be left worse off because of this decision to demolish the flats across Melbourne, and to make sure that we can protect and preserve public housing for current residents and future generations to come. And we also want to make sure that no land is leased or sold on unceded First Peoples land before treaty processes have been finalised. I was involved in a few different groups before I started 44FU. And what I realised pretty quickly is that the spaces that I was involved in, the groups I was involved in, I couldn't see my dad, one, finding out about them, and two, feeling comfortable or empowered working within them. And this isn't to discredit those groups. I think those groups play a particular role in this campaign, but I really wanted something to exist that would be accessible to my dad and people like my dad, for whom English is an additional language, and it didn't exist yet. So I was like, we've just got to start somewhere. So when we door knock, and this was very much intentional, I was like, I'm only going to door knock with others who are from the flats. And you would know this. We pick up on bullshit. You cannot say stuff to people that isn't true. Like, you will not get far. The doors will be shut on you. And we all know that because we're from the flats. And we're like, let's just give people information that they need. Most residents we spoke to, probably 95%, 99%, did not know that this decision was being challenged in the courts and that there was also a parliamentary inquiry into this decision. So it works in Home Victoria's favour to keep residents in the dark, and we know that. And the only information, by and large, that residents were getting was what Home Victoria was giving them, which is next to nothing. One information sheet which says, you'll be relocated, it'll be better for you, we'll look after you, and that's it. And it doesn't give you the how of how it's done. And since then, this is like, we're 2 years in now, when residents put questions to Home Victoria at information sessions, really based stuff like what's our buildings being replaced with, they get no answers. I'll give you an example. I was at a session in May this year on the Richmond estate, and the head of the relocation or engagement team at Home Victoria, who also worked for DFFH, when that question was put to her, what's being replaced, she was like, don't worry, when you move back into your public housing homes, it'll be just like it is now. And I had to stop her and say, did you just say that you're replacing them with public housing? And she said, well, we're not sure, but maybe some of it will be public housing. What we can go off, Ayan, is what's happened in the past. Flemington, I think 2017 was when the walk-ups there were demolished. We've spoken to residents who've been relocated from those walk-ups. When they were relocated back then, they were told that their buildings were just getting rebuilt, that they were old, they're getting built new homes for them that'll be good for them. They moved out willingly. And when they were told that it was time to move back, they were told that it wasn't actually public housing that they were building anymore. It was community housing, and the rent would be 30% of your income rather than 25%. Oh, and also, we've also built private affordable housing on the same land. That was 8 years ago now. But the only plans that the government's released for what will happen on these estates once these 44 flats are demolished
show us that there's zero public housing. It is all affordable housing and community housing. So it's abundantly clear to us that the lack of transparency is intentional. I know this being from the flats myself and speaking to so many residents now. If residents were given all the information that they should be given to make an informed decision about this, there would be so much more resistance to this decision. And I think that the state government knows that and is fearful of that. And that's the role that we play and other community groups play working together. We have to shed light on what is going on.
That was Aku discussing the lack of transparency from Homes Victoria. There's a lot to admire about 44 Flats United. Their campaign is all-encompassing. It's not just about raising awareness. Residents are also provided with the necessary information to make informed decisions about their lives. Nothing about us without us. We'll share contact information for 44 Flats United on our 3CR page at 3cr.org.au/ourstoriesourflats. You're listening to Our Stories, Our Flats, a 3CR podcast by and for the residents from the Carlton Public Flats. Next up is the trailblazing youth worker, Barry Barat. He sat down with us to explain what motivated him to take Homes Victoria to court. We conducted this interview before the Supreme Court handed down its judgment.
Hi, my name is Barry Berry, 30 years old, lived in North Melbourne since I was 6 years old. I like North Melbourne because it's, you know, closer to the city and it's got very good vibes there. Pretty much summer there for me growing up is pretty much like, you know, now, which is 30 degrees today, basically. You know, going to the pools with friends and families kind of thing, doing a barbecue, those kind of things. But pretty much just hanging out with friends and just can't wait for school to start as well, before the school starts. But also there's no air conditioner in the building, so everybody's out and about. People work back home until like 10 p.m. or 9 p.m. in the evening because of the hot weather kind of thing. And then also we'll have, when we were young, we always played basketball or soccer during the evening because it was really hot. It was really cool in the evening. So for us, it was just easy to play around. So I've been a youth worker almost for 10 years now. I've worked in different areas, different organisations, such as CoHealth, The Huddle, YMCA. I've been there for 10 years there as customer service. So working with young people that live in public housing, I've run my own community organisation called Young Australian People. We do like employment and pathway, encourage young people to look for them for jobs and stuff like that, and personal development. Yeah, so I was at home watching TV and I heard that ex-premier Dan Andrews announced it on TV saying that North Melbourne and Flemington is going to be in hard lockdown. And so what I did was I was shocked and surprised, and pretty much I called a few of my friends there from the community and told them, hey, did you guys hear about this kind of thing? And they're like, no, not really. And then straight away when the announcement came, there was about probably like 20 or 30 police blocked off the whole road of between Alfred Street and North Melbourne. None of the housing people didn't know what's going on, what's happening. So for me, it was just that to do. My mind just changed to community work, basically. And then straight away called all my neighbours, told them, hey, we're going to be on lockdown. And then me and one of my good friends, Mohammed, we went together to the shops, bought our essentials, came back, did our community work straight away, called everybody, called different departments. Tell them, hey, what's going on, what's happening. But during that 2 weeks, it was very crucial because we didn't know what's happening. And then slowly, slowly, they just decided to give us food that it wasn't actually essential for us. It was packaged pasta. It wasn't halal. It wasn't vegetables. It wasn't, you know, kind of thing. One of the big things that we did was we said to AMSA Mosque, you guys will be the essential center for us, for food relief and everything like that, basically. But yeah, so during that time, a lot of people have lost their trust in government in terms of what they say and what they do, kind of thing. They're very aware now. Since then, they've just started to realize they have a voice. I like to challenge myself in doing things. But also at the same time, this is my community. This is my home. the reaction of the community was, great job, Barry. Did extremely well. My parents, they were like, pleased that I was going, kind of thing. Because I have a disability, cerebral palsy. And so my parents were very, worried of me growing up in terms of, how I'll be in the society, kind of thing. For me, working as a youth worker, it just drives me to become in the community.
In April this year, the Supreme Court dismissed the class action brought by Barry Barrar on behalf of public housing residents. The court ruled that the government did not have an obligation to consult with residents before making their decision. An Overland article by David Kelly, Libby Porter, and Priya Kunjan, written after the court's decision, is worth reading. We want to quote a passage from the article that sums up our feelings. "The price of contesting landlord power, even through the narrow channel of legal remedy, is now being passed back to the tenant. In this system, even losing comes at a cost." I want to thank everyone who spoke with us for Our Stories, Our Flats. In making this podcast, we were nervous about how we might be perceived. We wanted to present our community in a good light, but that approach felt unfair and untrue. So we decided to encourage residents to tell it like it is. Our community is complex and nuanced, and we deserve to be heard. This is Raven Della Rogers-Wright. Thank you for listening. Our Stories, Our Flats is written, produced, and edited by Ayan Shoiwa. Narration by Raven.
It is really bittersweet to hear the last episode, hopefully just for now, of Our Stories, Our Flats. Do you want to remind listeners what we've just heard, Zakia?
Yes, we have reached at the end of our Stories, Our Flats series, produced by Ayan Shewa. In this episode, we hear from Rico from 44 Flats United about their campaign to define public housing, and community advocate Barry Bray shares what motivated him to take Homes Victoria to court.
Yes, we hope that you enjoyed this series. Thank you again for listening and for sharing the podcast with your friends. And if you did miss an episode or you want to listen again, you can now listen to the whole series by visiting 3cr.org.au/ourstoriesourflats. And we just want to remind you as well that we have drawn a winner for the Find Me at the Jaffa Gate giveaway, and that is Liz Shield. Congratulations, Liz. And thank you again to Tony Birch for giving us a copy of Michaela Sahar's book, Find Me at the Jaffa Gate, which is a beautiful narrative weaving together glimpses into Palestinian diasporic life. So Liz, we will be in touch with you via Instagram. Congratulations, and thanks again to everyone who entered the draw.
Hi,
I'm Jeffrey.
I'm Alphonse.
I'm Erwin.
And we are from the Voice of West Papua.
Tuesday, 6:30 until 7:30 p.m.
News and music from West Papua.
You're tuned in to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. And we are now going to hear a conversation between File Explorer and Inez about their latest club night, Fantasy Break, which started in early 2025 to champion the sounds of footwork from Chicago and jungle from London. File Explorer took this opportunity to further showcase alternative dance music in NARM with queer, trans, and femme selectors as a safer space away from some of the bro culture of mainstream club scenes and a place to truly let loose. Inez and File Explorer speak about how the first club night went, their music influences, the nuances of curating an event where people feel free to actually dance with each other, and what they hope to bring to their club night tomorrow, Friday the 3rd of October at QQQ St. Park, 2 Peel Street, Collingwood, from 7 p.m. to 1 a.m. Now, we will have information in our show notes about how Thursday Breakfast listeners can get an exclusive 50% off of their ticket. We'll have a link there, so make sure to head to 3cr.org.au/Thursday-breakfast for information after the show. But for now, let's listen to that conversation.
Thanks so much for joining us here today on 3CR Thursday Breakfast. How are you today?
I'm really well. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. Well, I'm wondering if you could first tell us a little bit more about you as an artist and more about Fantasy Break.
Yeah, for sure. So my artist moniker is File Explorer. I've been writing, I started producing music at like 12 years old and kind of, you know, have just been working away at it since. I'm really into the kind of, I don't know, the stuff that isn't really popular in NAMM, which is unfortunate, but I'm trying to change that. These things are like footwork, jungle, breakbeat, hardcore, just kind of fringe dance music scenes that are kind of coming back via TikTok and like 90s nostalgia. But yeah, I kind of like to explore, as my moniker may explain, but that's kind of me.
Yeah, brilliant. And I know that you spoke about Fantasy Break only coming out and starting in April. Why Fantasy Break, and like, what are you thinking about when you're curating a lineup and a kind of the story that you want to tell throughout the thing?
Absolutely. Fantasy Break was debuted, I guess you could say, in April of this year. I wanted to kind of expose the NAMM dance music scene to more of stuff from, you know, the outer countries. I feel like jungle and drum and bass kind of has had a long-standing relationship with NAMM, and a lot of people here, it's resonated because of, you know, I think colonization and like England coming in, and the culture of drum and bass and stuff developing there, and us having a connection to England through colonization has brought that. But I kind of wanted to like not have that tie to colonialization. And footwork, I guess, you know, is born from Black culture in Chicago. It's like born out of dance culture and creating stuff that, is made to dance. And so these two genres have kind of started to merge over the last 10 years, where like footwork jungle, I guess it's like a silly name, but it's just both of these genres combined, one from London, one from Chicago. It really exemplifies a lot of beautiful freedom in expression and dance, and you can kind of bring anything into it, and that's what I wanted to cultivate here, because I feel like in NAMM there's a lot of techno, which is great, but I think people need to get a bit more experimental, people need to get a bit more wild, and so bringing all of that together, because it's alternative dance music, I wanted it to be for not the mainstream. Like, I feel like culture develops in or outside of the mainstream. And being queer and neurodivergent myself, I kind of wanted to make a night that I feel comfortable in as well. Like, I don't know. I don't like going to drum and bass gigs where there's just heaps of dudes and they're all like taking their shirts off and just dancing around like, yeah. It just is like, I don't know. It's not a vibe. So I've really tried to kind of create lineups where it's majority femme DJs. I'm trying to be as diverse as possible, because obviously in NAMM, there's not a lot of people playing this music. So I've got like a list of DJs that do it, and thankfully most of them are femme, which is awesome. So it kind of, yeah, it just works out anyway. Does that make sense? Sorry, I've yapped for a while.
No, definitely. I think I'm pulling from a lot of the influences that you're talking about. And I think even reflecting on while you're talking, like techno comes from black music, footwork comes from black music. Jungle is also, yeah, Jamaican influences in the UK.
Absolutely. And
there's, you know, paying homage to a lot of that. And so much of that is outside of the mainstream, like white dance culture that, you know, you would be talking about. And even with you know, curating a space that feels like a legacy to that as well, involving all of that alternative section in a current night is like, it can be really hard to do, but I, you know, commending the effort, and also, yeah, booking is a really important task, and building those kind of relationships. And I know that you've had one previous fantasy break night. How did that go, and what do you want to bring into the next one?
It yeah, thanks. It went really well. Like, I was incredibly surprised. We the last one was at QQQ Street Park, which is like about 170 packs. And I didn't want to sell out. I didn't want the place to be full, because then you can't dance. So we sold 100 tickets, which was like 100 more than I thought I would sell. And like, I don't know, the vibe was just immaculate. Some of the DJs I hadn't met properly before coming, and they were kind of like, oh, I don't know, like this new thing. They were texting people like, is this legit? Anyway, they played and they were like, whoa, this is the best crowd I've ever played to. Like, you know, like, it just was awesome. Everyone was freaking out on the dance floor. That we kind of have like a no phone policy, so there's like, you know, you're able to express yourself without fear of being filmed. I want to take that forward. I want to get stickers. I want to put them on everyone's phones. I went to Solus and they did that. And I was like, well, good idea. So yeah, I think just creating a good vibe. I was thinking about doing free tickets for trans folk. But then I was like, that is like 50% of our ticket sales. Like, it's a really queer vibe. So I would like to do that. I'm just thinking if it's like financially viable for the next one. But yeah, like, you know, just cultivating awesome people. I know there's like a lot of buzz building within my friends. And I know all of the DJs are really stoked to be playing. So yeah, I just think do it again, make it a little bit better. But
yeah,
does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I really had a similar feeling, like going to Solus as well. I think it's one of the best dances that I've had in a long time. I think partly it was also about there's so much like discourse currently about how I think dance music seems to, yes, focus so much on spectatorship, and particularly with the DJ, and there's so much to say about that. But what I really liked about Solus was how the DJ was kind of, yeah, up on a platform and away in the corner, and people were dancing with each other, the phones were away. And yeah, if it's like any semblance of similar to that, I think it'll be a really amazing night. And I'm wondering, yeah, if you had any thoughts on, yeah, kind of where club and dance music is going, and particularly, you know, it's a lot of it is like queer and like people of color and trans people and gender diverse, and everybody's coming together to kind of like let loose in the night. And yeah, there's a lot of community in that. I think the first time I ever felt real community was also ongoing club scene as well, and that holds a very special place in my heart. And also learning I'm neurodivergent too. It's like, this is the best time ever. Like, it's high stimulation, beautiful music, beautiful people. And yeah, I'm wondering if you had any thoughts on the culture currently and what you wanted to bring into it, which you've spoken about a little bit.
Yeah, no, I have a lot of thoughts about it. Yeah. I think it's definitely, I guess just, yeah, with the rise of popularity in dance music and dance music becoming mainstream again, it means that there's more, I guess, consumerist culture around it, which, you know, is good long term because it means that more people will get exposed to dance music and find clubs and community. But it also means it's like saturated and it's just, it's becoming a joke in some circles. Like Resonant Advisor just posted a thing about like Kind music and I don't know, just like the Afro House movement being like completely led by white people and for white people like filming and not dancing. And it just, you know, it's easy to be cynical about the collapse of dance music, but really the antidote is like, you know, local culture, local community. And, you know, this ties into like the collapse of our 21st century civilization, I think. We're heading towards climate catastrophe, you know, jobless futures with AI, all sorts of like distressing stuff. But like, that's all going to end. Like, that's on an unsustainable route. But like, local community focused efforts can sustain themselves because, you know, we're all here and we're all here together. So like, that's kind of what I want to continue with Fantasy Break. I don't want to make it big. I don't want to, you know, sell out stadiums. I just want to keep it just like this reoccurring thing for the people who like it.
So, yeah, really beautiful. I think that, yeah, playing into how important local community effort and sustainability is, I think so much about dance music is, or club culture is, any systems that are outside will often replicate themselves inside, and making sure to build a local community safe effort is really beautiful. If people wanted to attend, which will be tomorrow, Friday, the 3rd of October, how can people attend and what should they bring into the space?
Yeah. So our event, Fantasy Break, is on starting at 7 p.m., the 3rd of October, 2025, at QQQ Street Park. Will be the venue closes at 1, but we've got a lot of hours there to have fun. There are tickets via Resident Advisor. If you're listening, you can get 50% off with the code HEART, HEART. And yeah, I would love you to bring an open attitude and a carefree disposition.
That sounds wonderful.
Awesome.
I will put that in the show notes as well. That's very generous with the discount code as well. But yeah, for the show today, it'll be on Thursday. And so that's tomorrow, Friday, the 3rd of October at QQQ Street Park in Collingwood.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you can buy tickets on Resident Advisor, and we'll put that in our show notes as well as the discount code for HEART, which is HEART.
Mm-hmm.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for joining us here today and, yeah, bringing such a breath of fresh air with these ideas, and particularly with Fantasy Break as well.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
No problem. Thank you.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings. Cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
You're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and it is 8:05 in the morning. You just heard a conversation between File Explorer and Inez about File Explorer's latest club night, Fantasy Break, which began in early 2025 to champion the sounds of footwork from Chicago and jungle from London. And you just heard as well that we got a special discount code to get 50% off your ticket if you're a Thursday breakfast listener. So make sure to head to our show notes at 3cr.org.au/Thursday-breakfast for details, for information about the club night tomorrow as well, Friday the 3rd of October at QQQ Street Park, number 2 Peel Street, Collingwood, from 7 p.m. to 1 a.m. So yes, we will have all of the information in our show notes as well as how to use the exclusive code HEART to get 50% off your ticket. There's also another event on tomorrow night, Friday the 3rd of October, where Race Rage is hosting Tea for Tea, Trick for Treat, a Halloween-themed night to kick off the spooky season at Cafe Gummo. So expect DIY Halloween props, a monstrously stacked lineup of trans and non-binary music, and a mini mutual aid market. Come dressed to distress and you might win the secret cursed prize featuring Lion, Ethiopian-Australian electro-pop star, Race Rage, a queer black rap brat, Heterophobes, a grunge punk three-piece, The Crop Tops, a group of trans folk punk rockers, and you can find tickets online by heading to humanitix.com/T4T-trick-for-treat. We will have that information in our show notes as well. $10 general entry, free for mob, nobody turned away for lack of funds, and it runs from 8 p.m. till midnight. So two amazing events competing for your attention this Friday night. Now we are joined by Vicky McNamara, a senior research associate at the University of New South Wales Centre for the Future of the Legal Profession. And Vicky joins us to discuss concerns about the use of generative AI in the Australian legal system, including by an increasing number of self-representing litigants. Vicky has extensive professional experience across private legal practice and with in-house legal teams, and joined the centre in early 2024. Her current research focuses on how technology, particularly generative AI, is impacting the legal profession and reshaping how legal services are delivered. Good morning, Vicky.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. How are you?
I'm great.
It's great to have you on, and I think a really important issue to discuss, which might, you know, fly under the radar for a lot of people. Now, to sort of contextualize all of this, I wanted to ask how frequently people self-represent in Australian courts, and is this more likely to occur in particular areas of the law?
Yes, we don't have a single national statistic because all courts and tribunals collect this information differently. But what we do know is that self-representation is more common in the lower courts and tribunals and things like the employment commissions, especially in areas of family law, migration, and employment matters.
Mm. Yeah, and how does the choice to self-represent relate to litigants' financial barriers to accessing justice?
Cost is definitely a key driver. I mean, many people simply can't afford ongoing legal fees. But access to legal services does play a role too, and in some regional and remote areas, for example, it's much harder to find a professional lawyer or legal assistant to give you some help. And some tribunals actually expect you to self-represent unless you get permission first to have a lawyer. Mm. So quite a common factor in many courts.
Yeah, and I think an important thing to keep in the back of our minds as we turn to talking about generative AI in this space. So first of all, what potential do lawyers and self-represented litigants see in generative AI when it comes to navigating court cases? Because, of course, this isn't, you know, this use isn't restricted just to people who are self-representing.
No, that's correct. And we're seeing plenty of lawyers using it on a day-to-day basis. I think what people see is the potential for making things easier and making things faster. And that's quite true. Generative AI does appear on its face to be faster and easier, perhaps, than the way you've done things before. And the tools are often free, and people are using it for lots of other aspects of their daily lives just to get things done. But it comes with risks. And, for example, you can type in a question. It gives you something that sounds really confident and comprehensive and quite seductive. Maybe could be better than what you could express it yourself. And it feels almost like magic when you compare it to trawling through pages and pages of stuff on the internet, like legislation or case law, or going to the inconvenience and expense of having to find a lawyer that you would like to work with and then paying for legal advice.
Mm. And, I mean, it does get to the sort of role of these tools as synthesizing information that already exists. But of course, if it actually comes to the point where you're using that in a case, there needs to be a process of verification, and that's where things can really fall apart. So tell us what you've discovered about the use of generative AI by self-representing litigants. What trends have you identified in the sort of outcomes and then the consequences of these cases?
So very, very clear trends. Firstly, whilst lawyers do use AI and have come unstuck on some cases, by far the greatest number of cases that we've looked at have been self-represented parties that have gotten into hot water. And we've looked at a lot of cases, not just in Australia, but across other similar sorts of jurisdictions like the US and the UK and Canada and New Zealand. So the biggest problem we're finding is, as you mentioned, when people use an AI to prepare their case and it makes things up, which is what we call hallucination. And then what happens is that fake or inaccurate material is then submitted to a court or tribunal without people verifying it. And verification means going and checking first whether that material actually exists, whether it's right, and whether it's relevant to a case. But it's not the only issue with AI use that we've found in the research that we're doing. Some other issues we're seeing are when litigants use AI to polish or embellish their submissions, and I'll explain why that's a problem in some cases in a moment. And another issue is when AI is used to generate reams and reams and reams of nonsense arguments, which has no legal basis and doesn't actually support their case. It's a kind of AI slop, if you like, which is the popular term that's doing the rounds at the moment. There's some points I wanted to make here. As a litigant, whether or not you use AI in your case, you must not mislead the court or tribunal or the other side in the matter. And you need to be really careful about what types of information you're putting into public AI tools like ChatGPT, particularly if it's sensitive or confidential information. And we've seen a couple of family law cases, for example, where litigants have put the names of children into the AI when they're trying to work out what to do, possibly in a contested custody matter. So that can be a real issue. But there's also some other types of court documents like affidavits, witness statements and character references, which must be prepared in your own words, and that's coming back to that AI slop point. You've got to use your own words for these documents, your own knowledge for evidence purposes, and that means a Gen AI version is not likely to cut it with a court or tribunal, as the AI dilutes or may rephrase or embellish or invent things, and that's a problem when it comes to evidence.
Yeah, that point on admissibility, I think, is quite important as well. And you know, you don't want to risk compromising a case that may otherwise be valid and really worth pursuing by engaging with these kinds of tools. To what extent have Australian jurisdictions introduced guidelines or restrictions on the use of generative AI in court? And what effect have protective measures had in reducing the risks that we've talked about for self-represented litigants?
So Australian courts and tribunals have been, I guess compared to some of the international courts that we've looked at, been a little slow, but there's certainly guidance coming out now. The Queensland courts were the first ones out of the gate, if you like, and they issued a guidance specifically for non-lawyers or self-represented litigants, as I prefer to call them. Then that was followed by the Supreme and County Courts of Victoria. They issued guidance in the middle of last year. And then the New South Wales courts introduced guidance right through all of their courts and tribunals at the end of last year, which came into effect earlier this year. And look, the guidance ranges in terms of how prescriptive it is or how much AI is permitted to be used. And I think the courts do recognise that people are using AI. So what this is really about is giving them some protective guardrails when they're actually using it to prepare a case in the forum that I've just mentioned. And other courts are looking at this too. The federal court, for example, has said that they are talking to the community about this, to the legal community and to other people involved in cases, and they want to understand what's the best way forward before they actually put something down on paper. And all of this helps reduce risk, but it also helps raise awareness of AI's limits when it comes to legal cases.
Yeah, and I suppose, you know, this is the sort of thing that you'd want to have front and center available to self-representing litigants. when they're, you know, about to engage in court matters or when they're about to prepare. So hopefully, you know, it will help some people to engage in, I guess, processes of decision making that reduce the risk of compromising their own court proceedings through the use of generative AI. But, you know, a lot of this, I guess, relies on self-representing litigants engaging with the guidelines and, you know, making sure that they go through those processes of verification. What other changes would you like to see in our courts and tribunals and also in the legal sector more broadly that could minimize the chance of people accessing inaccurate information online and then finding themselves worse off when self-representing?
I think one of the biggest changes that's become apparent to us in doing this research and looking at the material that the courts and tribunals are releasing is there's a real need for plain language AI guidance specifically written for self-represented litigants. And a lot of the current guidance reads like it was drafted by lawyers for lawyers, which it probably was. It's a missed opportunity when it comes to helping self-represented litigants help themselves. But it's not a technology issue alone. It's really a bigger issue about education, change and communication. And we really need targeted information to be developed on Gen AI use in litigation, not just for lawyers, but also specifically for other parties that use the court, including SRLs. And to date, I've found one body that really did try to tackle this in plain language, and that was the Fair Work Commission, but on a bit of a hunt around different court and tribunal websites. The information is sometimes really hard to find, and when you do find it, it might not really make a lot of sense to the average person.
Mm. Yeah, it is concerning that at this stage we still haven't met the moment in terms of providing accessible resources on how to engage or not with generative AI for people that are self-representing. And I think it also does speak to, I guess, like a broader societal, I don't want to call it tech optimism, but maybe naivety around, you know, how these tools function. And I did want to maybe ask if you had anything else that you wanted to add, because I am also reflecting on the fact that I work in academia and, you know, generative AI is becoming a big issue and a concern, both on the teaching and learning side, but also on the side of research and academic research publication. So just thinking more broadly about how to tackle AI as a cultural issue, you know, how does that intersect with the legal concerns we've talked about?
I think when it comes to the legal cases we've been looking at, verification is a big issue. That's a big education issue that we really need to help people get their heads around. It's really hard to detect AI in a lot of writing unless you're well-versed on some of the tips and tricks, if you like, that the AI systems generate. It's in the legal context, I think, you know, if you're putting it, looking at AI as a cost saver, that can be a bit of a fallacy. You may end up with a big legal bill anyway, such as a wasted cost order from court or tribunal, if you've put AI-generated material before a court and it's fake and everybody's run around looking for the information to try and check whether it exists and what it says and did it support the arguments being put. And you could end up footing an opponent's legal costs. And you really would only have yourself to blame in that scenario if you've used AI carelessly. And in a worst-case scenario, you could end up facing contempt of court proceedings, which we haven't actually seen in this country yet, but a number of our judges have flagged that that's a possibility in really egregious situations. Mm-hmm. So AI might look simple on its face, but it's introducing a whole new range of complications, I think, in all sorts of contexts, including legal cases.
Yeah, look, is there anything that you wanted to leave us with in terms of international best practice, in terms of regulation or international examples of concern that we should be looking at as we continue to watch this issue unfold?
Well, I think the contempt of court possibility is a real concern that's been raised both in England and Canada. But I think, setting aside the international piece, I think a little bit of self-help never goes astray. But there's some ways and means of doing it better when you're using AI, particularly to prepare a legal case. So first, always go and check the court or tribunal's rules on AI use. Go to its website or give them a call. I know that could be a bit challenging sometimes, but yeah, it's worth giving them a call or go down to the court registry and ask questions of the people who are on the deathbed because they're there to help you. And there's usually other useful information on preparing a case on court and tribunal website, including where to find other legal help and resources. And secondly, never file anything with the court or tribunal that you create using AI without verifying every source and legal claim in it. And you can do that using the many reliable and relevant legal sources that are out there and available for free. You can get to those like sources like Austley. There's information on legal aid websites and on community legal centre websites. And they often have plain language guides on most common legal issues. And you can also do things like go down to your public library, for example. Well, maybe the State Library of Victoria is not the closest library for everybody, but it's available online and they have lots of legal resources there that are able to access where you can go and check your arguments before you put them to the court. And I'd probably wrap by saying keep AI for low-risk tasks when it comes to legal matters, like outlining issues or explaining a legal term. But remember, it might be giving you the wrong answer. And always make sure that your evidence or submissions are accurate, that citations are to legal authorities that actually exist and are relevant, and that you use your own words for court documents like affidavits, witness statements and character references, because that's going to give you the best chance of actually having your voice heard in court on the day.
That is fantastic advice, and thank you so much, Vicky, for that. I know that the research report that yourself and your colleagues at the Centre for the Future of the Legal Profession is going to be released later this year, so we'll include a link to that site so that listeners can go back and read the full report once it's out. But again, really appreciate your time and for unpacking this very important issue that I hope does not develop into something bigger than it already is.
So do we hope. Okay. Thank you for the time to actually share it with your audience.
Of course. And that was Vicky McNamara, Senior Research Associate at the University of New South Wales Centre for the Future of the Legal Profession, who spoke with us about concerns with the use of generative AI in the Australian legal system, including by an increasing number of self-representing litigants. Vicky has extensive professional experience across private legal practice and with in-house legal teams, and her current research focuses on how technology, particularly generative AI, impacts the legal profession and has been reshaping how legal services are delivered. It is 8:23 in the morning, and you're listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR, 855 AM.
You might have heard about the Community Radio Plus app, but it's only when you start using it that you'll wonder how you lived without it.
You can listen to us wherever you are, at home, work, driving,
on public transport, gardening, protesting, or even in the bath.
Just search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.
I'm lucky and I'm clever.
It's time again for Done By Law's legendary annual trivia night. We know you've been waiting, and yes, it is here. Grab some teammates and come along to catch up with like-minded folks in the community legal sector and beyond, and try your luck at taking home trivia glory. We're raising much-needed funds for the incredible 3CR. 3CR is 100% community controlled and relies on annual fundraising to keep its amazing local content on air. Friday 24th of October, 6:30 p.m. at the Richmond Town Hall. Tickets available via 3cr.org.au/done-by-law.
Now we are coming up to time on our Thursday Morning Breakfast show, and we're going to take you through what we covered today. So first up,
we played a talk by Ana Cha of Brazil's Landless Workers Movement, MST, on the story of MST's organizing around food sovereignty and issues that movement has campaigned for over 40 years. This talk originally aired on 3CR's Earth Matters program on the 18th of May 2025. and was presented by the event's Food Sovereignty Day on the 12th of April, which was coordinated by Lezend Degwat. Network Australia and Grovula or Gardening Naram Collective. And also we had a series from our Stories of Our Flat series produced by Ayon Sherwell. And this episode we heard from Rico from 44 Flats United about their campaign to define public housing, and community advocate Barry Bear shares what motivated him to take Homes of Victoria to court.
Yes, and we hope that you've enjoyed listening to our stories, our flats, over the past few weeks. Today was the final episode of hopefully season one. So thanks again for tuning in. And if you missed an episode or you want to listen again, you can do so by visiting 3cr.org.au/our-stories-our-flats. After that, we heard a conversation between File Explorer and Inez about File Explorer's latest club night, Fantasy Break, which started in early 2025 to champion the sounds of footwork from Chicago and jungle from London. And the conversation ranged across the importance of alternative dance music scenes with queer, trans and femme selectors and moving away from some of the bro culture of mainstream club scenes. Fantasy Break is on tomorrow, Friday the 3rd of October at QQQ Street Park, number 2 Peel Street, Collingwood, from 7 p.m. to 1 a.m. And File Explorer has very generously shared a discount code for Thursday breakfast listeners, so you can get an exclusive 50% off your ticket by heading to the website ra.co/events/2250490. Don't worry, we'll have the information in our show notes, and including the discount code HEART. And finally, we were joined by Vicky McNamara, Senior Research Associate at the University of New South Wales Centre for the Future of the Legal Profession, to speak about issues with the use of generative AI in the Australian legal system, including by an increasing number of self-representing litigants. And while access to justice is really an important equity issue, and many self-representing litigants seek to self-represent because they are either financially unable or, just unable to access community legal services, it is so vital that when you are engaging in these processes, you're doing so in a way that doesn't risk compromising your case and also, putting confidential information into generative AI tools. Please don't take slop to court. It can really do you a disservice, and more than that, can result in lumping you with paying legal costs of the other party. So, yeah, definitely encourage people to listen back to this interview later on and to head to the Center for the Future of the Legal Profession's website, as they will be handing down a report on this research later in the year. And finally, a reminder about another event happening this Friday, the 3rd of October, where Race Rage is hosting Tea for Tea, Trick for Treat, a Halloween-themed night to kick off the spooky season at Cafe Gummo. So again, expect DIY Halloween props, a monstrously stacked lineup of trans and non-binary music, and a mini mutual aid market. This event is going to feature Lion, Race Rage, Heterophobes, and the Crop Tops. And you are asked to come dressed to distress, and you might win a Secret Curse prize. Tickets will be available online, and we'll have information in our show notes at 3cr.org.au/Thursday-breakfast. And it runs from 8 p.m. till midnight. Thanks again for joining us this week on Thursday Morning Breakfast. As always, we love your company, and stay tuned for Lost in Science coming up next. We'll catch you next week.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find NIBS opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall, Carlton. Keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.